This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As we approach the second anniversary of the war in the Gulf, the post-war euphoria is behind us. Saddam Hussein remains the head of Iraq. Was the war worth it? General Norman Schwarzkopf says, you bet it was. The general writes, Saddam has been defanged, and his militant voice is no longer relevant in Arab politics. And largely as a result of the coalition victory, the Middle East peace process is moving forward. General Schwarzkopf has a new autobiography in which he writes about the war and the occasional conflicts he had with the Bush administration. I asked him about the awesome responsibility of commanding a war.
I will tell you, right up until the very, very last day, I was hoping I wouldn't have to lead a war. You know, you don't want to do that. For several reasons. And in my case, of course, I also was burdened with the fact of knowing that my plans were the ones that were going to cause thousands and thousands of people to go into battle. And you really, really worry and continue to worry that you've got it right, because what you indeed want to do is, of course, accomplish your mission, but you want to do it with an absolute minimum loss of human life.
What was your last great hope that war would be avoided?
I think that when Secretary Baker and Tariq Aziz met in Geneva, and I watched that interview that night when Baker came out and gave that terribly pessimistic report, and then Tariq Aziz came out and talked for 45 minutes straight and didn't even mention the word Kuwait once. And I think I had a terrible sinking feeling of, well, that's it. You know, every other attempt to solve this thing peacefully has been thwarted, and this was the sort of the last chance, and I'm afraid we're going to have to do it now. I think that was the moment when I realized war was coming.
How close were you in on the planning of the air war?
Oh, I was I was 100% involved. What happened was in the very early days of the war, you remember the hostages and the hostage situation
yeah.
that was going on over there?
Yeah.
And I was very much afraid that Saddam was going to do something heinous against the hostages or against the American embassy in Kuwait or something like that, and we would be called upon to retaliate in some way, to answer that heinous act. And at the time, we didn't have any way to do it. So I turned to Colin Powell in Washington. I said, gee, I need the U.S. Air Force to come up with some options that we have so that if the president asks us to respond militarily to something like that, we have the capability. They put together an initial plan in Washington and brought it down to my headquarters. Now, at the same time, and I had Washington do it because my Air Force commander over in the Gulf, he was over there, I was still back here, and I'd put him in charge of everything over there, and I felt he had his hands full. I would be less than candid if I didn't tell you that he was very upset when I went to Washington, because he said one of the biggest mistakes that was made during Vietnam is we had Washington, D.C., selecting targets, you know, on desks in the Pentagon, and then they were calling over to Vietnam and saying, okay, day after tomorrow, fly these missions. And the pilots who were flying the missions and the people in the Air Force over there didn't even have any idea why they were doing it, what they contributed, and in many cases, they were very dangerous missions, and the people that had selected them weren't aware of what they were asking the pilots to do. So anyway, once Washington came down and briefed me on the initial plan, it gave me some options that I had immediately available to me. And then I said, now take that whole thing over, give it to Chuck Horner and his planners. And by the time I got over to Riyadh, Chuck and his planners came in and briefed me, and we went from iteration to iteration, and I was 100% involved in approving the planning process from that point on.
Did you think it would be possible at the time to not fight a ground war because the air war would be so successful?
Yeah, I hope so. What I was really hoping, I think when I realized we finally had to go to war, I was hoping that, you know, after the initial onslaught of the air campaign, that the leaders in Iraq would realize how futile it was to resist this thing and just call it off right then, you know, completely withdraw from Kuwait and comply with the United Nations resolutions. And that was always a hope. I think when we found out that, then before long, when we realized that, you know, that they were willing to just sit back and allow us to continue pounding them, it became obvious that the only way we were going to get this thing over with was to be able to go in on the ground. And, of course, it was only then that they, once we made the ground offensive, 2 days later, they announced that they were withdrawing. And so we did accomplish our purposes that time.
Could you share with us some of the thoughts that you had the first night of the air war?
Oh, yeah. It was, it's before we launched the attack, you knew this terrible thing was going to start. You knew this thing called war was going to happen. I sat down and wrote a long letter to my family. It's funny how many people have told me they did exactly the same thing. You know, you, you, We had all the threats about the Iraqis' use of chemicals. You didn't know what was going to happen to you. You didn't know what was going to happen to anybody else. And so really my last thoughts were of my family and the fact that I missed them desperately and that I wanted them to know that I was thinking of them at that time, because if something happened to me, at least they'd know that the last thing that was in my mind was my family. It was sort of an eerie feeling because you knew that you had issued all the orders you could possibly issue. I described it as standing at a crap table when you throw the dice in the air, you know, and they haven't hit the table yet. There's nothing you can do at that moment but wait and see what the outcome was. And then when the war started, we knew what was going on. All you can do is sit on your hands and wait for the reports to come in to find out the results. We had expected very, very high casualties that first evening because the air defense network that we were flying against was probably the toughest that any Air Force has ever flown against in the history of air warfare. And then all of a sudden the reports, you know, started coming, trickling in, and the reports were, you know, all of our planes were coming back and the missions were being accomplished. They were, you know, It was a combination of a sense of regret and relief all wrapped up in one. Regret that you had to come to this point, but relief that at least if you have to do it, you know, we were not suffering huge numbers of casualties, and that we were, you know, that the campaign plan was unfolding successfully.
Were there times early on when you felt that political concerns were at odds with military needs?
Yeah, I think that every commander who has ever been in the field, you know, has felt that way at one time or another. I honestly think that, you know, that there was at one point people were sitting back testing the air, you know, to find out if American public opinion was going to be for or against, and they didn't, and they were waiting until they got the answer to that question before they made a commitment. And that kind of bothers me, you know, when you've been sent to war, when you're sitting over there, you like to think that, hey, you're going to be supported, that somebody's not going to wait around until they smell the roses and find out which way the wind's blowing. Yeah. So that's something. But I think that in the times we live in, and given the tremendous communications that are available today, I think that's probably just going to be the nature of the beast in the future.
Let's talk about the beginning of the ground war. You say that you were ready to fight the ground war, but you felt that you needed 3 to 4 days latitude to make sure that you had clear weather to kick off the mm-hmm. campaign, and that yeah. the clear weather was particularly crucial to the Marines operation.
Right.
And you told Colin Powell that when he told you to be ready to start it in, 6.5 hours, that he was asking you to put aside military judgment for political expediency. Where was the pressure coming from and why?
I think that the pressure was self-induced in Washington. You see, when originally Secretary Cheney and Powell had come over and asked me what date we'd be ready, I said, I think we'll be ready on the 21st, but give me 3 or 4 days. Ultimately, I went back and said, okay, the date we'll be ready to go is the 24th. So you see, I had eaten up my 3 days. And what happened is shortly before we were due to kick off, the weather forecasters came in and predicted this absolutely terrible weather. When it was predicted, the Marine commander particularly came to me and said, look, you know, if we go with the weather that bad, we're just going to absolutely have a terrible time supporting our troops. And also some Army commanders, particularly the commander of the 101st, who had an air assault, who had a lot of helicopters that had to fly, came in, and they both said, if the weather's that bad, let's delay for 2 more days when the weather's going to be good. So what I had to do is, after Washington had sort of, I guess everybody was sort of mentally attuned to the fact that, well, we gave Schwarzkopf us 3 days and now the date is the 24th, and I had to go back in and say, heads up, the weather forecasters say things are really terrible. My commanders have come to me and said they need 2 more days, and this may have to slip to the 26th. And I think it was just, I think the attitude at that time was very much the same as the troops. You know, hey, we got to get on and get this thing over with. And I can understand the pressures that they were under, the public opinion pressures that they were concerned about and that sort of thing.
General Norman Schwarzkopf is my guest. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. General Norman Schwarzkopf is my guest. He has a new autobiography called It Doesn't Take a Hero. What were your worst nightmares about what would happen during a land war?
Very clear that, you know, we knew the Iraqis had chemical weapons, and they had used them against the Iranians. They had used them against the Kurds. We knew that they didn't hesitate to use them. And they were throwing up this huge barrier system in front of them. When you went back and looked at the Iran-Iraq war, what they did is they would wait until the Iranians would make their mass suicide attacks into these barriers. The Iranians would run into these barriers, get hung up, and then at that time the Iraqis would drop chemicals on top of them, inflict horrible mass casualties. That was their technique for defense. And everything that they were doing to defend Kuwait was following the same pattern that they used in the campaigns against the Iranians. So my worst fear was that we would run into this barrier system somehow, you know, the front lines troops would get jammed up, the rear lines of the troops would continue moving, you know, squash everybody into the barrier system, and then we'd have chemicals dumped on us and take mass casualties. So, of course, we did everything we could to make sure that didn't happen.
Why do you think it didn't happen?
Well, you know, this is speculation, but I would tell you, first of all, they, as a matter of course, they didn't keep their chemical weapons to the front. They kept them in storage areas in the rear. Secondly, they had the type of chemicals they used were types that degrade. So what they had to do was really load up their bombs, load up their artillery pieces prior to using that sort of thing. You got to remember that the very first targets we went after on the very first day of the war was his chemical storage facilities and his chemical reloads facilities. So number one, we probably took away an awful lot of his capability right then, or his capability to do anything. Secondly, we destroyed his transportation system. So he didn't have the ability to move the chemicals forward on the battlefield as he normally had done in the past. Thirdly, and probably more important, there was only three ways he could deliver chemicals. Number one, with his Scud missiles. We had been told 6 months before the war that he did not have that missile capability. It was only as we got closer to the war, there was a hedging of their bets again by some people in the intelligence community. Nothing changed, but it went from they definitely do not have it to, well, they might have it to, well, maybe they have it to, well, they could possibly have it to, they probably had it, you know, but nothing changed. I was quite sure he didn't have a chemical capability on his missiles, and it proved that he didn't. So that left him only two ways to deliver. Number one, by airplane, and number two, by artillery, which are the ways he delivered chemicals in the Iran-Iraq war. Well, we all know what happened to the Air Force, you know. Part of it ends up in Iran, and the rest of it doesn't fly anymore. So that eliminated that threat, and the last threat was the artillery. That's why in the latter days of the air campaign, before we ever launched the ground war, we focused completely on destroying every single piece of his artillery that was anywhere near where our forces were going to attack. So we not only took away the chemical munitions, but we also took away the ability to launch them. As a matter of fact, one of the statistics that's come out of the war is that 90% of all of the Iraqi artillery that was in the Kuwaiti theater was either destroyed or captured, and that was because we made that focus on his ability, you know. Finally, in the bottom line, and you never know what went through Saddam's mind. I tried to get inside his head a lot, and I don't think I ever succeeded, and I don't think anybody can. But, you know, if he had used chemicals, we wouldn't have stopped until we got him. I'm convinced of that. You know, so there was a point up to which perhaps he realized that if he were to use chemicals, that there would be retaliation, that we wouldn't stop, you know, until we had retaliated. And perhaps, although he never, ever used that kind of judgment in any other decision he made during the war, perhaps he made that judgment too.
General Schwarzkopf, you say that you didn't expect to have to negotiate the ceasefire with your Iraqi counterparts. What was it like to meet them after fighting a war with them? It seems to me the kind of human reaction would be to want to enter into an immediate fight. You know?
Yeah.
So tell me what it was like.
Well, you know, I realized that this was a momentous event, and I couldn't allow my own personal emotions to become involved. So I sort of steeled myself to, look, this is going to be done very correctly, very properly. I had an advantage, you know, Terry. It's great to be the winner in a situation like that,
right?
Because, you know, you already got the upper hand, and you know that you're going to be in charge no matter what. So in that I knew I was the winner, and I knew that they knew that we were the winners, I had sort of steeled myself to not let my emotion get involved. And then when I flew into Kuwait and saw the black smoke pouring into the atmosphere and you know, the destruction of the oil wells and this absolutely stupid, inane, meaningless act of destruction that was, you know, polluting the world, I really got angry. And when I first landed at Safwan, I was all emotionally involved again. And what I had to do was sort of remove myself from that and say, well, wait a minute, go back to being what you're required to be at this time. And that's sort of dispassionate about the whole thing. Because what I really, you know, what I was focused on at that time, I was focused on getting our POWs back and getting an accounting of our MIAs. I didn't want to go through the the agony that we're going through still over the Vietnam thing. So my first focus was I'm gonna lean on these guys. We're gonna do whatever we can to avoid continuing fighting with each other, and at the same time, I'm gonna lean on these guys hard to get our POWs back.
But actually, talking to your Iraqi counterparts, was that a very difficult thing to do?
Well, I hate to say it, but inside I was gloating. Okay? Maybe I wasn't outside, but inside I was definitely gloating.
As the winner.
Right, yeah, right.
If you're just joining us, my guest is General Norman Schwarzkopf, and he has a new autobiography called It Doesn't Take a Hero. One of the big debates within the military has to do with whether it should be legitimate for gays to serve.
Yeah.
Now, Barbara Walters asked you about this Friday mm-hmm. night on 2020, and just excuse me for paraphrasing, but what you said to her basically, well, let me ask you for your answer instead of
right.
me paraphrasing you.
The government position on this thing has been the same for quite some time, and it's been one that's been upheld in the courts. This has nothing to do with sexual preference. It has nothing to do with discriminating against people because they are gay. Our experience has been, everybody's experience in every military organization's experience has been that unit cohesion is something that's so important on the battlefield. It's the single most important determinant in whether a unit succeeds or does not succeed, this ability to hang together for everyone to depend upon everybody else within the unit. And, you know, you really end up in the final analysis when you're face-to-face with the enemy, you know, fighting and depending upon the person on your left and the person on your right. Now, there are obviously gays in the military, and they've obviously done a great job. But these are not people who have overtly announced that they're gay. And we found that almost, at least when I was involved in the business, almost universally when someone did announce that they were gay, or that several of them were gay, it almost instantaneously caused a polarization in the unit that really destroyed the cohesion within the unit. I'm not saying that that's right. Please don't misunderstand me. I'm just saying that that was a sociological happening that occurs in a closely knit organization like the military, and we found that it was really it's a question of what's best for the defense of the nation. And it's on that basis that the military has consistently said that gays, openly gay, and is not compatible with the mission of defending the country.
Isn't that on some level, though, that like saying if there are white soldiers who are racist, better to not let in African-American soldiers because it would be divisive?
Well, you know, and at one point that was a policy. I mean, it wasn't that. We had
segregated
units. You know,
right,
you had 100%
right.
black units and 100%. And we have worked our way through that. Okay, you know, I'm very proud of the fact that the armed forces, as far as I'm concerned, was the first institution in this country that really was completely integrated, and we made it work long before anybody else did, and we're all very proud of that. I'm just saying that what I'm telling you is the reality of today, and you know, and I understand all the pros and cons of the argument, but you've got to understand that, you know, coming from 35 years of military service, ultimately, when I have to come down on a very tough issue like that, I'm going to try and view it from the standpoint of what's best for the defense of the nation. And it's, you know, another argument that's very similar to that, another debate that's ongoing right now that's very similar is the debate about women in combat.
Mm-hmm.
Another very, very tough issue where you have two precepts of the Constitution sort of clashing with each other. The arena of equal opportunity and equal rights, you know, would argue for, you know, sure, 50% of all of your organization should be female. The reality is that that's not a good idea in some cases for the defense of the nation, although I would tell you that I am far more supportive of women's roles in combat than a lot of my colleagues are, and I have always been an advocate of women in the military because they do such a great job and they make such a great contribution. But if you really want to get down to splitting hairs, you know, you got to say, okay, what if 50% of your infantry battalions, these are the guys that are in the trenches, you know, or range, let's be even more dramatic. What if 50% of your ranger battalions, these are the guys that sneak behind the lines, wrestle, you know, hand-to-hand combat with the enemy and this sort of thing. What if 50% of them were female? Does that, in fact, degrade the combat fighting efficiency of that particular Ranger battalion if it comes up against a Ranger battalion that's 100% male. I think you got to say, logically, that, yeah, that probably does. And therefore, you've said that there's got to be some sort of logic applied to what combat organizations women are part of and what combat organizations women are not a part of. And therein lies the problem, because now you got somebody who's going to make rules, and when you start making rules like that, you're never going to please everybody. I would tell you that I, unlike many of my colleagues, I'm in favor of women in the cockpit. I can't very well argue when we had women medevac helicopter pilots that did such a magnificent job in the Gulf, mm-hmm. flying around in the heat of battle. I can't understand why you can't have women flying in combat helicopters, too. I mean, there's no logic to that to me. So as I say, my colleagues get upset with me when I make that comment. But it's a very, very complicated issue. And in the military, we got to remember that, you know, we got to try and focus on the fact that the primary mission of our military is, in fact, first and foremost, to defend our country. And therefore, when you do come to places where these precepts of the Constitution clash, one of the two of them has to take preeminence, and in this case, I think defense of our country is probably the one that I would vote for.
One last quick question. Where do you have your uniform now?
Well, I've had a lot of requests for my combat fatigues, you know, and I've sent them off. Some of them I've sent off to charities to auction. One of them's going to go in the Imperial War Museum in London. The Smithsonian has asked me for some of those uniforms. But they're so, you know, it's... I hate to say it, but it's hard to give them up. So I sort of have them pushed way back in the back of my closet, gathering dust right now, most of them.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Terry. It was a great interview.
General Norman Schwarzkopf has a new autobiography called It Doesn't Take a Hero. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.